Welcome to the Vank podcast. I'm your host, Lies Serdans. And today we dive in the life of Kenny Schachter. Do I pronounce it right, Schachter?
Yes.
Yeah, it sounds really German.
It is. It sounds scary, you diving into the life of me.
Yeah.
But thank you very much for coming here and for speaking to me. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having us. Do you know your biography when it's generated by ChatGPT?
It can't be worse than the real thing.
Yeah, I'm going to read it to you. Kenny Schachter is a well-known figure in the contemporary art world. He is an art dealer, curator, writer, and artist based in London and New York City. Schachter is recognized for his distinctive voice of unorthodox approach to the art market. He has been involved in various aspects of the art world. Schachter gained attention for his role in the 1990s as an art dealer and promoter of the Young British Artists.
It's completely wrong.
Yeah. A group of artists based in London, known from their proactive and often controversial artworks. He has also created exhibitions and organized art events around the world. As a writer, Kenny Schachter has contributed articles and columns to numerous art publications, providing commentary and insights into the art world, its trends and its personalities. He is known for his candid and sometimes critical perspective on art market and the inner working of the contemporary art scene. Additionally, Schachter is an artist in his own right, creating conceptual and often humorous work that reflects his engagement with contemporary culture and world dynamics. Overall, Kenny Schachter is a multifaceted figure whose contributions have left a significant mark on the contemporary art landscape.
Okay, goodbye.
Is it true?
The second half is very nice. I'll accept. I mean, my curatorial. Well, first of all, I can't sell drugs to a drug addict. So okay. I've resorted to art dealing for economic necessity to make a living because not early on, we can get into it, but when I discovered art as a profession, I made art since I was a little child just because I was very isolated in the suburbs of New York, and I spent a lot of time on my own, and how I occupied myself was making collages. And for me, art has always been it's a life, and it's a means of survival. It's solace, and I mean, I live surrounded by the art, my art and other people's. So my home is more, I mean, the space is more just a sanctuary for peace and for inner kind of exploration and curiosity. But back to the commercial side and the inconsistencies with good old ChatGPT. Yeah. If anything, I think, you need to pay a monthly subscription to get the more updated version.
I didn't do it. Yeah.
And then maybe it's more accurate, but good chance. I made my own ChatGPT. Where I fed 1,000 pages of my text.
Oh, really?
And I created, so if you go to the ChatGPT, but you need to be a subscriber, I'm pretty sure, you can use my own writing to get a description, or you can use it to apply to your own work for a kind of critical response to your own practice. But like I said, I did resort to art dealing just to make a living, just because I wanted to have a life in the art and because I'm self-taught. I've never taken an art class in my life until I was teaching in 1992. That was the first art class I was ever in as a teacher. That's another story. But my career was begun in New York in the late 80s, early 90s. And it was from curating here in New York with emerging artists. An emerging artist could be 20 or 100. It's a misconception to think that art is for young people or art is expensive or many other misconceptions. But my curatorial practice and how I cut my teeth in the art world and defined a role for myself, I created a role for myself, was through curating in New York, similar to what you mentioned you were doing with your residency program and taking over uninhabited spaces. there was a great recession in New York from 1990 to the mid 90s. And I would trade or hustle my way into getting spaces. The word pop-up didn't exist. We used the word guerrilla shows or hit and run. And I staged exhibitions for emerging young artists, old artists, artists that didn't have a consensus around the appreciation of their work, artists who didn't have any gallery representation, mostly not even group exhibitions, largely. But also it was to create a context to have my own work seen. So once I made the determination that I would pursue a life in the art world, in it's a very unforgiving, very exclusionary, very unwelcoming place. Mm. So I had to really, every day to this day, I've been doing it for nearly 35 years. And even though the opportunities I've had in the last 5 to 10 years, well, especially the last five years or so, have been flourishing and mushrooming, but it's still so hard fought. And people think like, oh, you have a platform, you have power, you have... I've been working 7 days a week, and I most assuredly do not complain, because this is the only thing that gives me joy. So I love my art. I love my work. I love to teach. I love to share. I love to help other people. In fact, I had some tragedies in my life, the loss of one of my kids 5 years ago. If it wasn't for art, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. So I had nothing to do with the YBAs other than having a close friendship with Tracy Emin, who's an inspiration to me on a regular basis. She's also someone who's her determination and fighting through personal tragedy and adversity is extraordinarily admirable. And that's a role model, and various other people I've come across in my life. Vito Acconci, the conceptual artist. Again, like some, yeah, I can. I'll take a breath. Otherwise, I can go on for 3 hours without punctuation.
I think it's very interesting what you say. And sometimes I get the impression that artists are looking for a moment that they're in Belgium. You say you're on a train, you made it, you're on a train, and the train is leaving, and the train is left, and you're comfortable on the art train, you will be successful for the next coming 20, 30, 40 years. But is there such a train?
No.
Or is it always a
struggle?
If
there is such a train, it's left me at the station.
Okay.
So, I mean, look, I won't settle for, I'll do what I do, whether people offer me the opportunity to or not, I will make it happen myself. I created my own platform. First, I curated my own work in group shows. I mean, I introduced the work of artists like Cecily Brown when I couldn't give them away for $1,000. Her auction record is $6 or $7 million, but it's irrelevant. Wade Guyton, who makes art with a computer printer on primed linen, Joe Bradley, Catherine Bernhard, a load of different artists. And mainly, as much as I was interested in creating a platform for artists when there was no other opportunities for them, I was interested in finding a way to show my work, because I made art and nobody gave a rat's ass about it, and they still don't. So yes, I had a museum exhibition at the Francisco Carolinum in Austria from September to February of this year. And a book is coming out shortly. And I have an exhibition in Los Angeles that's up now, but
yeah, it's called I Object.
Yes. It's just, look, it's not easy. It's never been easy. I'm not on that train. Some people would say I'm successful. I would say I'm a successful failure. I mean, I'll never take no for an answer. Nothing will ever change. I have a lot of self-doubt, a lot of insecurities, but I make art and I write about it and I teach it. And if you don't give me a platform and a forum to do so, I will create my own, like I've done before and I'll do again. So I'm not on that train. If anything, I'm in the back of the train, because I don't have a big art market. I had some various successes with NFTs and opportunities to show with a gallery in Berlin, Nagel Drexler. But it's very hard fought because I don't paint, and paintings sell. There's a parallel universe between the commercial success in the art world. And I mean, as a conceptual artist who makes largely computer work, but also I had a clay sculpture in my last show, but then I scanned it and turned it into a multifaceted digital output. But yeah, so, you know, people should just focus on what they care about and not the what other people are up to. But that's human nature.
Yeah, I think in this also you have different kind of artists, people who are just making the art between four walls, and you have the entrepreneur art that if they don't have a show, they will create a show. And I think in the second case, it's maybe more proactive than in the first case.
I mean, I think I'm just a if you take everything you just said and put it in a blender, that's me.
Okay. That is good. I think it's very, very fascinating. What I also find very fascinating, I was scrolling through your Instagram. Yeah. And the funny thing is, no, maybe not funny, the strange thing is people or artists, they project what is upcoming in their life in an announcement way. But you don't announce things. You don't announce, like, I have a show in Los Angeles. No, you reflect on the reflection of the show and then you interfere it into something else. And then the announcement of the show drips somewhere through, and there is no clear lines in it. So I always try to grab my head around, okay, so what's the thing with Kenny's Instagram?
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it is ad hoc, seemingly random to some extent. I'm a person, when I had this museum exhibition, I was given a free rein. There was very little, if any, curatorial oversight. Same with the book that's coming out. And the first impulse may have been to showcase work over the course of my 30 years in the art world, 35 years. But I mean, my interests lie in what's now and what the future may hold. Not in any kind of, like, I mean, I'm filled with self-contradiction, so I'll probably contradict myself 15 times during the course of our conversation. And although art is the only thing that's significant to me. I've never taken a holiday in my life that didn't have something to do with art on some level. You can give me a 7-star holiday on a beach and I'd rather go to the dentist and get some teeth pulled. No interest. I have outdoor space where I live. I've never been outside in 5 years. I want to be in front of a computer, reading, studying, learning, pursuing. Life is so short, so I try to compact it as densely as possible and learn. I teach to learn. I taught my first class because once I became aware of, I never went to an art gallery until I was 26 and a half. It's an old story by now, but I was so naive. I call myself idiot savant. I didn't even know that you can have art in a domestic context. My mother passed away when I was very young and my father was on the border of abusive to me, which a lot of people have had it a lot worse, but it wasn't easy. I wrestled with, the reason I never shut up is I had trouble. I had a speech impediment. I used to stutter and I was overweight and I was just, I was miserable. I've only become quasi comfortable in my own skin over the past 5 years since I became sober. And that was it wasn't precipitated by any personal crisis or any textbook case of drug addiction or alcoholism, but I was just doing too much of whatever I get my hands on because I just don't have a lot of boundaries and I'm very obsessive compulsive and I like chaos and that's a dangerous mixture. So I didn't know galleries existed. I didn't know you could buy and sell art. I never went to a museum until university. And then when I found out about art, I was like struck by an epiphany, a revelation. And then I thought I didn't want to go back to school after unrelated graduate school. So I enrolled in a teaching job so I would learn art history the hard way, having to sit up in front of a class and teach them about something I knew very little, if that, about.
Yeah, I think it's good because you have an idea and then you go with the idea and then you take the problems with it and you see how it goes.
The crazy thing is that people would say that I'm up to my eyeballs in the art world and I'm entrenched and an insider's insider, but I will always have the mentality, the mindset of an outsider because I am an outsider. I've never been welcomed into any situation without really fighting for it and attaining it. I love that because when I approach art, teaching, writing, making work, although there are various aspects, of course, the history is so you can't get in. The reason I taught was to learn what happened to art once it came off the wall of the cave. Hmm. I can teach anyone post-war art in 5 minutes off the street, 6 months, say, just from avidly reading and picking up on various things. But you need to know the history. So I couldn't bear the thought of attending class. So I took on a teaching job, bought the generic art history book from university, read 3 chapters, drank a big beer to get my courage up, and then taught those 3 chapters and then started over again.
Then if you would give some advice to emerging artists, what would it be? What should they do wrong and what should they do good?
Well, I got a lot of advice. Yeah. Like I said, my kids certainly don't listen to me. Well, I think the most important thing is don't take no for an answer and never give up. The only way you succeed is through, it doesn't take gifts, whatever that may be, a facility to draw, you know, a particular depth of knowledge or being what you would call smart or something like that, or wealth or family resources, none of the above. What you need is perseverance and tenacity and hard work. It sounds so simple but it's true. So you just have to never give up and fight for it. I mean, one of my closest friends, incongruously enough, was the Iraqi architect Zaha Hadid. And I was just in awe of her prowess, this formidable human being that through great adversity professionally never gave up after not building a damn thing for like 30 years. And she was undaunted. And I wasn't a particularly connoisseur or particularly interested in architecture per se, but I curated projects for her, wrote about her, and traveled to a dozen countries with her, and we had lunch every week. I had this great, luxury is not the word, but I had this great, I was lucky enough to spend these years with her and learn from her. And I wasn't interested in learning the formal attributes of brutalism or any form of classicism in architecture. I was interested in learning how this woman had the fortitude to persevere in light where in the 80s, she famously won a major competition and then in Cardiff in the UK for an opera house. And they just couldn't bear the thought of giving an Arab woman the money to build this building. And they just took it away from her. And she won a competition to build something in Hong Kong and various places. And it just never worked out until it worked out. And in the end, she worked herself to death. She didn't have to work twice as hard as a man. She had to work 5 to 10 times as hard as a man. And I spent so many, you know, years with her towards the last decade of her life. And she taught me so much about, work. And also, I make an ass of myself every day. I humiliate myself. I embarrass my children. I don't care. You have to fail. There's no accomplishment. Forget success. Success is a stupid term that some people value money. I could care less. Money enables me to get art and to make stuff and to travel. And like I just went to Zurich, I had a marathon 8-hour lecture day and I had 2 days of teaching minus breaks. I don't know if I'll ever be able to do this again. There was like a 6-hour lecture in one day. I pity the poor students. But I put so much work into preparing for this. I've learned before the hard way what it's like not to be fully prepared, trying to wing something, and it's dreadful. And it's really, it's painful to your self-esteem, not to mention for the poor people that have to listen. But what I learned, what I think is most important, back to what you said, is you have to fail. You have to be prepared to embarrass yourself, to make yourself, if you're playing it, I don't believe in complacency. That's a great fear of mine, is ever to just be, if I have too much downtime between projects, it's depressing and it's debilitating because, yeah, I just think you have to expose yourself, you have to push yourself, and you can never get comfortable. Being comfortable on some train would be a nightmare to me. No interest in being comfortable.
Like making 20 years the same type of paintings.
I mean, in a way, like, you know, what am I going to do if my art was selling for $1 million? Like, go on holiday? Like, again, like, go to a different restaurant. I eat the same shit every day. I don't care about food. I don't care about anything. I wear the same old track pants every day. I dress for comfort. And I love art. I love to surround myself with it. I love to talk about it. I love to think about it. I never say no. I didn't know who you were. Your name in English is Lies, which I think is pretty cool. Because I work in the realm of the truth, and that creates the greatest fear. That's the enemy of the art world, is they hate the truth. They're scared. They're cautious. And I flout that.
Yeah, I saw that my name was creating some chaos.
I like it.
Yeah, it's a bad name in English.
No, it's a great name.
It's a great name. Yeah, I never know how people, if they look through it or they think, maybe I should doubt it, but it's coming. As you say that you make a fool out of yourself, it's really strange that you say it, because on the other side of the ocean, when we're looking through you via a screen, it doesn't look like you're embarrassing. It's like an icon working in the field that you do. So we don't have the feeling that you embarrass yourself.
I'm not trying hard enough.
Yeah, you want to embarrass yourself, because then we can help on the podcast.
I mean, recently I discovered an old photograph of when I was a child and I was wearing this little outfit, and then I remade the outfit and then took a photograph wearing this child's clothing as an adult. And I would say that qualified as fairly humiliating.
Do you know the Belgian art scene well?
Well, I don't know anything well, but I know a little bit about it.
Do you know what is your favorite Belgian artist? You know some?
I beg you, don't insult me.
Yeah, you never know.
Panamarenko?
Yeah, okay.
Thierry de Cordier?
Yeah.
Marcel Broders?
Yeah.
Is Guillermo Bile?
Guillaume Bale is my favorite artist.
He's a cool guy and he's a friend. Yeah. I mean, not a friend, but I have a work and I really like him. And I remember seeing a work in the 90s that floored me. I was in, I don't know where I was, Basel. And in a gallery, he recreated a supermarket the first time he did it back 30 years ago. And there was like 2,000 objects in this gallery, and he absolutely replicated a full-blown functioning supermarket. And I like his humor, his conceptualism. And I hated to be associated with YBAs. Like I said, the only one I respect is one who would recoil from being even called a YBA, Tracy. But like, Damien Hirst is dripping paint all over his face and the back of his ears, calling himself a painter when he was an extraordinary conceptual artist. What is he running from? That's what he does. That's what he did. People always want what they don't have. The grass is always greener-ism, I call it. Robert Longo and Cindy Sherman made films as directors. And musicians want to make art. Artists want to make music. And Damien Hirst will never be a painter. He made a comment that anyone could learn to paint like Rembrandt. That's just pure bullshit. I mean, maybe if you start like Picasso did when he was in the embryo of his mother, and that's another story, because that's the kind of, you need to really have that hunger, not just something you make a determination in the middle of your life that, I'm going to be a painter because it seems more romantic or whatever.
I'm not a big Damien Hirst fan, but I like the show he did at the Biennale of Venice in Palazzo Grassi with the sculpture he found. And I liked it.
Don't make me nauseous.
You know why I liked it? He got me. I really thought that they discovered a new...
Oh, Lord. You're so gullible.
I was so...
Yeah, because your name is Lies. You like Lies.
Yeah, that's the thing. I
No, I think that was overfabricated. Let's change the subject.
Okay. No, you can say it.
No, I don't want to say it. I don't even want to enter my consciousness.
Okay, so you're not a David Hirsch.
I like the animals in the vitrine. They were brilliant. And the first spot paintings reference pharmaceuticals. When you get to be my age, everybody needs pills to live. And to make art out of it is very thoughtful and very, and I like that very much. And to make something that like seemingly looks very happy on the outside, but every spot relates to a particular pharmaceutical, the dominance of pharmaceuticals. I lived for 15 years in the UK. And when I came back, I forgot that media, television is dominated by adverts for pharmaceutical companies. And at the end of every glorifying TV commercial for what this pill could do and what that pill could do and make you skinny and make you happy and literally both. And then at the end, they're like, may cause your penis to fall off and you may get cancer. But other than that, it's great. So whatever. But I like, yeah, I like art that makes me think. I study philosophy and what attracts, I wish I could make a beautiful picture, but I'm incapable and it doesn't hold much sway. Beauty is such an arbitrary notion as it applies to fine art, but I like things that make me think. And for me, art is a formal manifestation of an ideational, yeah, thought.
Yeah, and maybe you can help us with a question because we were talking about it when we came here. We have no clue what NFTs are. And the more we read about it, I think because we're two women.
Blah, 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 blah.
Women. Yeah, we don't.
Some of my favorite NFT artist is Sarah Friend.
Yeah.
She's a woman.
Can you explain it to me so simple?
Yes.
That I know it.
Yes, but first of all, let's be clear about some things. Yeah. I don't give a fuck about NFTs. Even though I just wrote a book about it and I've sold lots of them during the brief period of time. I was able through my lecturing and teaching to help hundreds and hundreds of people, if not a bit more, to make money from their creative production for the first times in their lives. I had written off the hope that I always thought I would need to sell art or take jobs or do stupid things to make money. And then I'm probably the only person that got involved with NFTs in 24 years ago without any intention of making money. I just thought I can develop a new audience to see what I do. So let's just start with the fact that I showed my first computer animation in 1993. I made computer prints in 94, 95, 96, and I'm still doing so. And contemporary art, to me, is a reflection of our social, political, economic, and technological times. It's a comment upon it, and it's a reinterpretation of it and various other aspects relating to that. It's also a means of expression between people. So very early on in my life, before you can, I'm so old when hamburgers were 5 cents, before there was a point in time when I was a child where there was no such thing as a home computer, a desktop computer. Forget laptops. You couldn't even put it on your desk, yet your lap, and especially not your phone, a smartphone. So originally, back in the 1970s, the only way to get a computer, computers were mainframes, mainly from a company called Cray Research, and they were these gigantic devices, oftentimes filling vast rooms, halls, buildings for computing power that could be replicated with a telephone today. But originally they were in a kit for hobbyists to build themselves. That was the only computer you can get for domestic context. Just like I didn't know art could be something for the home, nor were computers even an option. And I remember that my dad worked in a carpet company, and as a kid going into this room and seeing these vast rows of machines and these computer paper attached to it, and it was awe-inspiring. So from a very early age, I had this inkling, this vision that computers would be a formidable presence in our lives in time to come, in the same way AI, all this bullshit about AI destroying civilization, people destroy civilization. I've never met a dishonest computer in my life. So I had a desktop when I was in graduate school and I used it. I mean, imagine when word processing first became a tool. It changed the way you formulate a sentence and a paragraph by shifting the way that you can shift your thoughts and edit. And I bought an IBM desktop when I went to law school because I studied philosophy and there was no job for philosopher with an undergraduate degree other than a high school teacher. Lawyers are insidious, worse than art dealers. I like art dealers. I don't like dishonest, disingenuous people that are hypocritical. And that's a lot about my art and my writing. The art world has its own brand of hypocrisy, and it pisses me off. I'm kind of angry still. I'm not normal. That I never promised anybody. And so I went to law school just to hide. I never went to class. I told my family and my employers I was in night school. There was no night school. I did take the exams. I felt it was my obligation because I got some help to get through law school. And I took the bar exam, but never with the intent for one day to follow through with it. And it taught me the kind of discipline to sit and learn about art, really. It gave me this structure, mental capacity to apply myself to the hard work that it takes to present a lecture for 2 hours or 6 hours or stage a show and write. It takes a lot of work. I mean, for someone like me who has such a fleeting attention span, I could sit for 10, 12 hours without even noticing the time go by when I'm doing what I love, which is writing and teaching and making stuff. But anyway, I didn't forget your question. Having the clarity of thought of being sober helps that. And so I always, for me, the technology, I mean, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, who founded Apple, they got the idea to domesticate the computing device for the home through this Heath kit, which was the name of the company that made these kits. And the rest is history from there. Heath kit was the name, H-E-A-T-H. That was this company that made stuff for hobby people that love to tinker. I like to take things apart, but often you'll hear parents say, my child took apart the radio or the car and put it back together. I would lose interest after I take it apart.
And then it's
I like breaking stuff. I like seeing what's inside, but I don't have the patience to put the shit back together again. I like to mess things up a little bit. Anyway, back to your question. So I showed my first animation in 93. I still make computer animation. Did I animate it myself? No, I storyboarded it. I drew pictures of what I wanted to convey. Art appears in my mind's eye, often whole. And I'm not a cook. I like my food to be cooked. I do drip my own coffee. But I don't enjoy I'm not a process-oriented person. I like to think, I like to do. And when I conceptualize something, I want it made. And like the way Zaha used to make, she had 400 architects working for her. And she was more hands-on than, I mean, for decades, she painstakingly drew every drawing she made deep into the night. When there was electricity cutbacks in the UK during various economic recessionary periods, she worked by candlelight into the night with gloves on, with the fingers cut off. She was just, her work ethic was awe-inspiring. And anyway, okay, so let's just forget all this bullshit and cut to your question. So David Hockney used to be a very open-minded artist. He started working with the iPad as soon as the iPad was brought to consumer culture. And he, well into his 80s, he had a very open mind to explore new means of creativity. However, ultimately, he hit the wall. And I speak specifically in regard to your question. He thinks NFTs are for criminals, not even good criminals, small-time criminals. And the fact is, look, people say the art world is unregulated. That's absurd. I mean, there's more crime at Goldman Sachs, at an investment banking company, in lunchtime than there is in the art world in an entire year. So it just gets amplified because the art world is relatively small industry. in relationship to other technology, automotive world, entertainment, etc. So anyway, back to good old David Hockney. So he said NFTs are for criminals. Yes, crypto is rife. It's a cesspool of corruption. It's the last place where you could launder money, tax evade, and then smile and go have a nice meal at a restaurant and with no fear of retribution, because it's going to take the taxing authorities a good decade to catch up. When they do, be careful, because they're going to come after people with impunity. Anyway, so David Hockney said NFTs are for criminals. However, I would use his work to answer your question. What is an NFT? So would you rather own, David Hockney makes a drawing on his iPad, he brings it to a photography lab or the gallery does, and they make a photograph. And it's going to cost you 50 grand, whatever it is, if not 300 for a photograph, let's say, you know, a meter by a meter. And that's the art. However, would you rather have that, the photographic output as dictated by a gallery, or would you rather own the high-res file within which he created the work? So I've been making digital art if NFTs did disappear and I could care less. Nothing will change what I do. If I have a gallery show, I'll fill the gallery. If I have a museum show, jump at the opportunity to have a wider audience and expand the platform I have for my work. Would it change one iota anything I do today, tomorrow, or the next day if everything dries up and I never sell a piece of art again? Absolutely not in any respect. This art runs through my circulatory system and it's all I care about and all I know about. Anyway, so think of digital. There's been digital art. Vera Molnar is a brilliant woman, just passed away at 99 years old, French conceptual artist that utilized computers in her art for decades. Lynn Hirschman Leeson is a hero of mine. She's 83. She's an extraordinary human being. She has been an unsung artist. She's had opportunities showing at the New Museum in a retrospective and San Francisco Museum of Art and various other international museums. But she has a tiny, if that, art market, because the only thing worse than being behind the time is to be too far ahead of the time. This is a woman who's been making art with AI for 25 years. I mean, there's a great documentary. You could find it, or anyone can get in touch with me for the rest of my life, because they're all your listeners will in all probability live longer than me. I love to help people. The art world only knows one word, the word no. No, you can't do this, say that, behave
very
like this.
Judgmental.
It's what do you call it? Suffocating. And I believe in basic kindness and compassion and consideration for other people and what that they're going through, things that you went through. And like I said, like I have a show in Los Angeles. I sold I don't know, half a dozen pieces, and it's a struggle. I'm not going to lie to you. It's not easy, but I don't want easy. If it was too easy, I would just watch TV and not do anything. Masturbate or something, which Vito Acconci made a famous artwork out of. That was a bit random. In 1972, Vito Acconci made a work called Seabed. It was very inspiring to think that you can make a career out of that. But anyway, so NFTs are just a tool. Unless you use the coding technology, use the smart contract as a conceptual element in the work, and then the NFT becomes art in and of itself. But as far as I'm concerned, I employed computers like Vera Molnar, Gottfried Jaeger, Herbert Franke. These are artists that lived either, Gottfried Jaeger is in his 80s, Herbert Franke just died in his mid-90s. As I said, Vera Molnar died at 99. Lynn Hirschman Leeson is 83, and she's going on all cylinders. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant woman. And she has a film retrospective coming up at the Museum of Modern Art in a few months. So for me, computers are the same as a paintbrush. In fact, they're more interesting than a paintbrush, because I love painting. And painting, since it came off the wall of the cave, has been coveted. And it's most easy to display a drawing or a painting, and my house is wallpapered in art. But I think in the future, the dedicated devices for the display of digital art will vastly improve and progress to the point where perhaps other means of art behind, besides a fucking painting and a drawing, will hold the most sway and attraction for the art market. When, I mean, the ChatGPT also mentioned the art market a little bit too much for my interest. I could care less, and I find it a big bore. But I'm interested in chronicling human behavior as it relates to the world of art and artists. And artists have, art and the market are two parallel lines. I always say they have sex together, but they sleep in separate beds. Artists from the Renaissance were obsessed with money. Rembrandt was obsessed with money. Da Vinci had various issues in relationship to his patrons. Albert Dürer launched the first lawsuit for trademark infringement. He said that, why should I make a painting when I can make more money from a print? And he would have his assistants sell his prints across Europe to fund various travels that he would undertake. So the art market is a pain in the ass, but it's an evil necessity because you need to make a living. And I don't have the capacity to make a pretty picture on canvas or paper or anywhere. I can't make a, yeah. So I have to find other means of survival to do what I care most about. And I do.
Yeah, but I think in this conceptual way of being an artist as you are, I think you've done very well, because it's a different road and it's a difficult road, but you took it. And
it's all, I mean, it
it's
took,
next to the train.
It but took me. It took me. But look, I mean, I was, there's a woman called Tina Rivers Ryan. She was the curator of this, of a museum in Buffalo, the Albright Knox Museum. And she was just appointed the editor of Art Forum magazine. And she's embraced digital art for her whole career. And then somebody asked me, after the fact, to be on a panel discussion with her on Twitter. And I said, sure. And she told the organizer that she wouldn't do it if I was going to participate. I never met her or had any interaction with her in my entire life. I just knew of her from Twitter. And then I thought, well, that's interesting, because I don't deserve that kind of treatment. Maybe my kids would beg to differ. But, and then I asked someone who was her teacher, a great artist called Claudia Hart, who's been working with AI, algorithms, blockchain for decades as a teacher and as a practicing artist, great artist. And she said, these people think you're just another middle-aged, powerful guy in the art world. Mm. And that pisses me off. Like the judgmentalism, again, I've hustled for every opportunity I've ever had. So like, again, what's the perception of success? I mean, I published a book that I contributed to with MIT. I published this recent NFT book. I did a book with Vito Acconci, published by Springer Verlag. I've been in various documentaries. I've had a solo museum show. I was in a show at the Kunsthalle in Zurich. But how I'm going to make my next dollar is utterly and entirely unknown to me. It is really disheartening. And it's like, yeah, my kid makes these, my kid Adrian has an exhibition right now in New York City up for till the 21st of April. And he's an extraordinary human being.
He's a painter.
He's an artist.
Okay.
So in this exhibition, he has a room of ceramics. Mm. They're wonderful and wildly unusual, and a room of paintings. The paintings are all inspired through digital inputs. He's played with AI. He did this incredible video that I exhibited in a show I curated with 100 NFT artists in 21 in the beginning of the movement, in the early stage of NFTs. And he uses AI, he manipulates images, creates his own images, and then paints them in a painstaking technique, which is unbelievable. I'm jealous. And So I would. He also does fashion on the side. I mean, he makes his drawings that are translated into fashion. He's just really iconoclastic and quirky. And because he's such a great painter, he does. He's 27, and he just had this extraordinary show that all but sold out after a few days, and it was amazing. I weep thinking about it. It's so touching. I had to fight him to get a painting. I mean, literally, it was a battle. He just didn't want to sell his painting to me. He'd rather someone from outside the family. He's an anti-nepotist, and he wants nothing to do with me. I mean, he appreciates the fact that I've curated, when my kids were little itty-bitty kids, I began curating exhibitions with them as a family all over the world. In China, in London, New York, and LA, mainly because I wanted to encourage, like, everybody just wants to be rich and fucking famous for not doing anything. And I think you have to instill experiences into children. They're so swayed by social media, by what their friends are doing. Like you mentioned, your conception of me through Instagram and through what you've heard, I'm not that person. I'm a person who's really sincere, really hardworking, and really caring. And I come across, I know my writing could be brash and harsh and satirical, critical, but it's all heartfelt. And it's, I would say, back to your advice for young people, you have one life. You better pay attention. Bruce Nauman made an artwork where one of the printers screwed up one of his prints, and then he etched into a plate, "Pay attention, motherfuckers," written backwards. And it's like, you have one life to live, so you'd have to find a way to do what you want. The great civil rights activist, I shouldn't reference, well, I mean, it pertains to life and to art as well as the civil rights and trying to have parity between people of color and the dominating factors in society. But he said, by any means necessary. Not to be frivolous or flippant, he was referring to the fact that it's a life and death situation, and he's prepared to do what he has to do to gain freedom and to gain equality, which still does not exist, even though great inroads have been made over the past decades. Look at even women artists. I mean, the museums and the auctions are dominated by male artists to this day. And even though the opportunities have mushroomed for artists of color and women artists, it's still nowhere near where it should be. And now abortion is illegal in this country. It's disgraceful. I'm embarrassed for some of the right-wing policies espoused by the leaders of this country. And the political quagmire and the human suffering across the world is disgraceful. Why can't people just fucking get along? It's, I don't know, you know, it's just disheartening. It's human nature, because it just never seems to improve. But anyway, love and passion are what drive me. I love art and I love my kids.
Are all your children artists?
Two of them are. One of them that passed was a brilliant artist, so talented and so successful. And he took his life at 21 years old. I don't want to start weeping thinking about it, but I will. But he got into graduate school at Slade, one of the greatest art colleges in the world, without ever having gone to undergraduate school. And he just bottled up his feelings and his pain. I just wrote an essay for the artist Matthew Wong.
I read it.
For the Van Gogh Museum. And
it was
he had success. He was on the train, a bullet train. I mean, his paintings, I mean, it's disgraceful what's happened since, that the market, like in a macabre, morose way, danced on his grave and speculated in his work. But his paintings there was a waiting list for his paintings at $60,000, a secondary market of more than that. And he took his life when he was at the enviable heights that most people will never achieve. And that wasn't enough, because if you're not well, if you're not feeling okay, then nothing could help. And that's a situation, you know. So anyway, life is short. You have to find what you love, what you care about, and then do it by any means. And for me, art is, I mean, I used to joke that artists, even though I've always been one, art, when I was curating a lot of shows to make a living, artists could be very narcissistic and very self-absorbed. Not me, of course, never. But I always say they're always looking over your shoulder while they're talking to you, looking for the more important person, and Yeah.
Yeah, not all that, because at our company, a lot of artists are really full of self-doubt.
Sure,
we try to push them a little bit more to get a little bit more out and go talk to some people.
Yeah.
I think it's also, we had in Belgium, we had the thing, the elevator pitch. And everybody, every artist should remember an elevator pitch, that if you're in an elevator with somebody very important, you should say the pitch.
I just think, look, if there's someone I want to like suck up to, or someone I think that could, like, I'd want to see my show, I will come up and say, like, you know, please see, I have a show, blah, 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 I'm Kenny. But I just think, you know, yeah, you shouldn't really reduce yourself to a mere encapsulation of what you think comprises you. You should just try to, like, encourage, take a look at my social media or whatever it is in a nice, people lack manners. I mean, people, I will entertain every single DM email that comes into my box. I respond to, oftentimes within 24 hours. I encourage people to, if people are having trouble with the drugs and alcohol or suicidal thoughts, like, I'm no counselor. I have no professional training, but I have experience, and I will share my feelings and things that have helped me in the past. And, you know, my family has always been extraordinarily close. But there are a lot of difficulties, economic, mental, the pressures of your peers, of society, expectations of people, how hard it is to even fulfill your own conception of your own life and what constitutes, you know, we keep throwing around these terms of success and trains, and it's just, yeah, it's always going to be difficult. Anything good is hard and difficult. Nothing comes easy, and I'm not interested in what comes easy. I'm interested in that. I mean, again, like, I don't make process-oriented art, but I'm interested in the process of doing what you care about in a thoughtful way.
What's your next thing? You're already thinking about your next thing?
Yeah, I mean, I have this book coming out, which I'm most excited about, the first monographic book on my art, which is in production as we speak. And I am working on some new bodies of work without any, some things have come up to me, I've thought about on what to do with some of this work coming up in the near term. My next exhibition is in November at Nagel Draxler in Cologne during the Cologne Art Fair.
Oh, it's nearby where we live. We'll come. When is it opening?
In November.
November.
Whenever the art fair is. Thank you.
Okay.
I would love that. And
yeah,
if you ever want me to come to your program and speak to the students.
Okay.
It would be my, do studio critiques.
Yeah.
It would be my pleasure. Honestly, that's what I mean. Like when I started before, like when I went to Switzerland for this weekend of teaching, my kids were like, what's the fee? And I explained the fee, and they're like, well, that barely covers your expenses. I'm like, in fact, there's a bit of a shortfall. Mm-hmm. And I don't care, because that's what I do. When I teach 6 hours and I've never repeated a lecture in my life, I leave that classroom having learned something. I get into that classroom having learned something. And I think, like, I always want to push. I always want to curate. This insatiable curiosity defines artistic practice. There's also been studies that I was going to mention before about people looking over your shoulder for the next opportunity. Something I would say early on in my career, when I was more focused on working with other artists than my own work, was that artists behave like they're curing cancer. They're so righteous and so absorbed with themselves and you know. And now there's been clinical studies at various institutions from Harvard all over the world that there are medicinal ameliorative health consequences from surrounding yourself with art, making art, that there are calculatable positive results,
effects
in the same way you bring a dog into an old age home and it reduces anxiety, depression, blood pressure levels go down. I mean, when I'm in a bad mood, which is quite, yeah, I could be a bit grumpy, art is the only thing. I mean, drinking, it's such a mistake and a romantic fallacy to think that, like, you get inspiration by drinks or drugs. I mean, That is how you harm yourself. I was smoking marijuana every day for decades. I never was a heroin addict or a cocaine addict or pills, but I smoke. Anything you habitually rely on is terrible. It's a crutch, and what I thought was helping me, God knows I've written a load of articles near blacked out on occasion. It doesn't help. It hurts you. I get 3 times the amount of work done in a fraction of the time at a much higher level of quality. And I have no regrets in my life. I've blacked out hundreds of times. I'm not proud of that. It was sloppy, and that was very detrimental to my career. I've always been achieving. I won't say high achieving because it's not quite as high as it could have been. But that's the only regret I have in my life. It was fun. I had a lot of crazy times wasted. But I can't, as I'm in like, you know, as I'm getting older, I realize how essential time is and how limited it is. And I don't want to be younger. I don't want to look youthful. I don't really care whatsoever about that. But all I care about is how much time left is there. And I'm not looking to accomplish something, to get a show here or be in the museum of this or the museum of that, or to, you know, make X amount of money. I don't care about that. I just want to keep seeing, doing, thinking, learning, meeting other artists, meeting people like you that just come through my inbox. And here you are. And by articulating these thoughts, it helps me. It's nice to meet you. I'm very interested in your program and what you do. I'm learning from you, and I'm learning from me by being in this position of taking this very seriously, our interaction. And this is what it's all about. Art. This is art as communication.
And is it a characteristic of you, like being so generous, or is it something that came with the experience? And
that's a great question. No, I mean, I was so dumb. Like, I was naive. I wasn't able to articulate even what my own, I had no interests. I had no hobbies. I had no passions until like I went to university and I found philosophy, and it was a revelation. It was an epiphany. Just like the way that I found art was when I was in law school working all these jobs, it ranged from working on the floor of the stock exchange. I thought maybe that could be something, but I used my fingers to add and multiply. So that was never going to work. And then I was a legal writer. That's how I learned to write, by honing my skills, writing and doing things that I didn't want to do. And that gave me the discipline. It was like military school for the head. But what was the question again? Now, finally, I've lost my train of thought.
If the generosity is...
No, because I was fucking miserable with myself. I hated myself. I had really low self-esteem, filled with doubt. Only in the last... I mean, I've always been giving with my time, helping my children, caring vastly about doing these shows with them. I never had any encouragement ever. All I was told was how shit I was my whole life, and having no mom and... No, I never had any of that. So there was one determination I made that if I had children, I would treat them in an entirely different fashion and try to nurture them in ways that I never had. And I missed that because it's just, again, I don't care that, again, like people have had horrific hardship in their lives. And I'm very fortunate in the overall picture of my life. I'm not complaining. I just think in terms of like having a fucked up childhood, time lost, being wasted for 3-4 decades, time lost. And now that I have this incredible focus and clarity of thought, I want more. I want more time. I wish all of that frivolous time, being literally drinking myself into oblivion, I want that time back. God knows how many brain cells have been dissipated that you can't reclaim. And that's, you know, there's a billion people that want what you want. So you have to just try to focus. And yeah, you know, I have a great path that I've followed over the years. And again, like I reiterate that I feel very grateful. I'm very grateful for sitting here talking to you, that you want to listen to me, that I have something to say. I think it's my obligation to try to help for others what I never had myself. No one helped me. I mean, I've given like the director of the museum in Linz, Alfred Weidinger, is one of the most profound, brilliant people I've met. There's another German She's a writer, Annika Meyer. We've had our fights and battles. And she asked me to contribute an essay for this, the first institutional historical overview of digital of NFTs in 2021, because they first began in approximately 2017 in earnest. And I exploited that opportunity by putting in the lyrics of, I was thinking about all the gratuitous critiques. The art world is the most conservative industry field that I have ever been in my life. I've worked for law firms part-time, for financial institutions. You wouldn't know it by looking at me. I worked for a fashion company because I wanted to do something creative, but I didn't know art existed as a career. Nothing prepared me for how fucking backward-looking and archly conservative the art world is. The model of galleries dates back to the 1700s. There's an insurance company called Lloyd's of London, where two old men would sit around a martini glass and shake hands on an insurance deal in London. And that's the model of the art world to this day. They don't encourage innovation. I had this idea before I professionally got involved that everyone in the art world was drinking absinthe, hanging from the chandelier and going to orgies. But it's like, it was so backward looking. And then back in the 80s, I went to procrastinating between jobs. I stumbled into Sotheby's, where Andy Warhol's estate was being sold, not even understanding or being able to appreciate what Andy Warhol's work constituted as a historical departure to what had come before him, having seen it in the museum of the East Wing of the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., where I went to college. And then they were gearing up for a commercial auction at Sotheby's, and they were selling Warhol's collection. He had traded with Basquiat, Hockney, Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg. And I was dumbfounded that you can actually pay some money and have some art. I saw an ad in the newspaper shortly afterward for an exhibition by Joseph Beuys, Cy Twombly, and Sigmar Polka. I had studied specifically German philosophy, and I was drawn to German art when I first got involved. I went to that gallery dressed probably worse than I am now. And I saw that I could buy a Cy Twombly print with a crayon drawing on it for $5,000. And I was flabbergasted. I needed it. I didn't want it. I had to have it then and there. I had no money, but I had a job. I passed the bar exam somehow. And I took a part-time legal job until I could figure out what I wanted to do. I walked into the bank, asked for $5,000. And they said, for what? Before they were about to call the police. And I said to buy like a print with some crayon on it. And they were going to they threw me out. And then because I had a job, I had the law firm call up the bank and I got the money. And then I became, whenever I've had to deal art, it's never been to collectors because I don't have the patience. I am not a salesperson. If you don't know what you want, don't come to me. I'll tell you what I like, why, but I'm not going to tell you. People have art advisors to tell them what they should like, or, you know, either you do it or you don't. Or again, I don't begrudge anyone for doing anything. You should do anything you want. If you want to buy 2% of a fucking Picasso painting, I think it's grotesque. But if that's what you want to do, do it, because it spills over and it creates breadth, wider breadth in the market, which is great. More opportunities will trickle down. But I got the loan, and then I started selling stuff to other dealers, because dealers have made the leap of faith to understand, know about, and appreciate art. So it was easy. It was a way to educate myself and incorporate the economic necessity of having to work. Mm. I'm exhausted. I'll take a nap.
Yeah, yeah. We're also going to round up. It was really nice that you invited us to your home. And maybe I should describe the home. It's fantastic. All the art hanging here.
This is all my stuff. There's a body of work that have to do with copyright. And when I make NFTs, I may be the only artist in the world that doesn't take royalties in the work. Everybody in the beginning was claiming how revolutionary this is for artists to be able to get royalties. Mm-hmm. I did in the beginning because I didn't know there was an option. Mm-hmm. But when the market collapsed in 22, I started to elect what's called Creative Commons, and it's an alternative to copyright. It's when you don't assert a copyright in your creative production, meaning that anyone could do whatever they want. It's in the public domain. And I don't take royalties. I think if you're going to, I was selling art for like between $3,000 and $20,000. And then the market collapsed and I was making the same art and selling it for $10 or $100. And I felt, strangely enough, I felt the same satisfaction when somebody wanted to buy my art, whether it was $100 or $20,000. I could care less. But I felt when the market, it really clarified it for me that why should I charge someone a royalty for perpetuity? Why should they have to pay me if they ever want to sell the art? I'm grateful they want to buy it in the first instance. So I'm not going to carve out an income stream for myself out of, you know, their commitment to buy and support my work. So behind me are a series of paintings that I had fabricated in China from digital art that I made. And now I use bespoke robotic devices from a particular company called Art Matter to make some paintings. And I use...
Why in China?
Affordable.
Okay. Good. It's interesting because it's like the big clothing companies.
I don't
companies
have a lot of money to...
Yeah, but it's,
I mean,
really,
it's all... As long as people are not... I mean, if there's exploitative work practices, then I feel like an idiot. I mean, you have to be very aware of the circumstances upon which something is... If you're going to engage other people to do something, A, you have to be forthright about it. I know a load of artists that are showing at some of the biggest galleries in the world today that are not forthright about the extent of how they make their work. If you're a sculptor, you need to fabricate things if you're not conventionally carving something. I think if you're a painter, either you paint it by yourself or you make it clear that you have collaborators. I can't paint. I mean, it just, back to our little friend Damien Hirst, it just came out that he was artificially aging his sculpture.
Pre-aging.
Look, Picasso did that. Picasso dated paintings from the 30s and 40s in the 50s and 60s because they fetched more money. It's certainly nothing new. I've known a handful of artists that have done such a thing. But then to artificially age a sculpture, he claimed that he had... the date related to when he conceived the pieces. But that's complete absurdity and dishonest and fraudulent. That's a fraudulent misrepresentation because he couldn't even break the sculpture with his own hands to make it look like it was old. He had to get his assistance. I've made 25 satirical videos about his work over the years. And there's one that's in production now based on this very instance. Cause I find this kind of, again, like it has nothing to do with art. It's human nature. You see some of the most beautiful life affirming acts of generosity between human beings. You come into my home. I'm so grateful to meet you. I'm grateful for your time. Grateful to the audience. It brings me to life. And at the same time, there's a lot of people that could behave very awfully. And it's really disheartening. And it's these other moments of generosity of spirit, which give me hope. A good way to come to near conclusion is that the name of my book and my show in Austria was Keep Hope Alive. And there was a friend who was a collector and he was trying to help me get something I wanted. And the collector was full of shit and lying and duplicitous and really badly behaved. And he was very self-made Irish business person who was in horse racing. And he mentioned the name of this horse called Keep Hope Alive. And the horse never won a damn race in its entire life. But I just, for me, I'm never going to achieve conventional success in my life. Like, you know, when you think of success, there's one religion left in the world, basically, and it's money. Whether you're in China, whether you're in Russia, you can have modified versions of capitalism. I mean, I made works critiquing Mother Teresa. I mean, she's been sainted and she did a lot to help poor people. At the same time, as a child, I'll never forget watching these TV commercials where she was using poor people in her missionary zeal to convert people to Catholicism. The great British social political critic who died of cancer, Christopher Hitchens, he wrote a book called Missionary Position, critiquing Mother Teresa, that she took money from Babyface Duvalier, the Haitian dictator, and various people that were implicated in the savings and loan financial crisis in the United States. And then I see these TV commercials for dogs, like to help, we call it the ASPCA, which is the foundation to help animals in distress. And you see these animals like on the screen shaking, like give the fucking thing a sandwich, like some food with this. Instead of like, I understand you're trying to, it's like, yeah, people, I just think there's an aspect of humanity which is very destructive, very disheartening, and outright miserable. And look at, you know, the Israelis were provoked by Hamas. The Israelis retaliated in a disproportionate fashion. There's a leader in Israel who should be unseated. Putin is like, for no reason, from one day to the next, invading a country, just minding its own business, the amount of lives, the devastation. I mean, I studied the German philosopher Hegel, and I'll never forget like mentioning, like when a child sees something outside of itself, the first inclination, it's the other, it's this thing outside of itself, and it takes this object and puts it into its mouth to try to consume it and to overcome it. And unfortunately, this kind of, people are at loggerheads, like fighting is something which is in our genes. I mean, we fight, we don't get along with people, it's part of human nature. Families fight, everybody fights, and I just think if there was more art, as simple as that sounds, more dogs. I love children. Children are fret. They don't have a filter. I don't have a filter. I had a bad childhood and I've made up for it over the years by saying and doing what I feel like without hurting anyone or breaking the law. Generally speaking, people should do what they want, how they want, without being constrained and throttled by outside societal forces. And art has no rules. You do what you want as long as you find a way.
On the other hand, I think your generosity will inspire us to also be generous. So I think it will work the other way around also.
Yeah, I mean, there are exceptions to everything. And like I said, like I love teaching. I love my students. I love my children. And like we battle every day. We fight all the time. Terrible fights. Say terrible things to each other. But just this morning when I resolved the battle to get one of my kids' paintings, he didn't want me to have this painting until the show was over, but the painting is not even in the show. And he hasn't taken, by the way, the ceramics have only started to sell a few, but the paintings are all gone. The ones in the studio, out of the studio, in the show. That's the way the art market works, sadly.
It's difficult, ceramics.
So he didn't want me to have the painting, and we fought and we screamed at each other, and it was unpleasant. And, but we resolved it in a way that I was being
thoughtful. Why didn't you buy his ceramics then?
I have his ceramics. I love his ceramics.
Okay.
I have my eyes on one, but because I got the painting, I'm going to at least give it the opportunity to try to sell to someone else. And then I'm going to zero in for the kill. Don't tell him.
No.
But yeah. Okay. But it's true. Like even me, I mean, look, I'm not Mother Teresa, no matter who she was. She did a lot of... I'm a human being. Mm. So like... Yeah, I think it's easier to own a painting than it is a sculpture. They're fragile ceramics. They break. Paintings, you can knock them around. The reason people continue to be drawn to them is because they're easily movable, transportable, storable. Mm. Hang them here, hang them there, put them in storage, bring them to Sotheby's. That's what people like. That's what they'll always like. It's sad, but so what? So if that's what you want to do, if you love to paint, paint. I wouldn't dissuade anybody from doing it. You still see wildly contemporary paintings that are relevant to society.
Thank you so much, Kenny, for this talk. It was really inspiring and amazing that we're welcome in your home.
You come back whenever you want.
Yeah, and I'll put in the...
my social media, DM me, send me an email.
Yes, there's also all listeners, DM Kenny.
I mean, my phone number is actually on my front fucking door right
really?
Now.
Really? Yeah, I saw it.
Because I was expecting a delivery and my doorbell is broken and I kind of prefer it. So I don't want anyone surprising me. I like my solitude. Mm. I need alone.
Okay, and we also put in your exhibition in Cologne because people will come.
Thank you. And I write for Artnet for the most part, but I don't care. Read it, don't read it.
Yeah, okay.
I don't care.
We'll put a link in.
Do what you want.
Thank you, Kenny.
Thank you so much.
Ciao.